Hi, and welcome to episode 18 of the Unpacking Weight Science podcast called Obesity, Unpacking Risk versus Disease. I'm your host, Fiona Willer, weight neutral professional development dietitian, academic and size acceptance advocate. Our learning goals for today are to identify the differences and similarities of a risk factor versus a disease state, appreciate the historical, political and financial context of the decision of some to deem a BMI of more than 30 a diseased status, and understand the consequences of using the label obesity and its classification as a disease. When I was planning this episode, I thought, cool, what I'll do is compare and contrast the definitions of disease and risk factor, because surely they're well defined. I feel like I have a good handle on what they are, and then discuss the case for and against the ramifications of a larger body size having that label assigned to it. Easy! Except that the definition of disease was remarkably slippery and horrifyingly subject to the whims and insistence of the people who studied or treated people with those characteristics. I noticed that the people who hold the characteristics, symptoms, or signs under scrutiny have literally never been involved in the decision to name the condition or whether it should be deemed a disease unless they themselves both had the condition and were a scientific researcher of it. There's some clearly huge medico-patriarchal BS happening in there. Anyway, so what I'm going to do is talk about the definitions of disease and some of the historical context around where we've ended up with some of the world deeming a larger body size as a disease in itself, and other parts of the world considering it as a risk factor. At its core, the question is being fat the same as being sick? And can telling somebody that they're sick, even when they're not, actually make them sick? So let's explore whether having a BMI of greater than 30 for an adult human should be considered a health risk factor, a disease, neither a risk factor or a disease, or both a health risk factor and a disease, and the consequences of those classifications in the real world. Firstly, why is the point of interest a BMI of more than 30? BMI as a metric is weight-centric, but not inherently fat-phobic. It is a categorization and labels that are ascribed to those categories which are fat-phobic. BMI as a formula is elegant in metric, but unwieldy in imperial measures. The cutoffs are suspiciously round numbers. It is incredibly unlikely that a biological organism just happens to have risk profiles that fit accurately into a 5-point categorization. Make no mistake, while the normal BMI category was set around the lowest unadjusted mortality risk point in the data that they had at the time, the rest of the categories are purely because they eyed the risk curve and wanted to use nice round numbers in increments of 5. If those categories had been named neutrally, perhaps they would not have been so stigmatizing. The first category, being named overweight, with surprising lack of synonyms, instantly offers judgment about the appropriateness of a particular BMI. So there's a correct weight that someone is over, and the term obese, which had frequently previously been teamed with the word morbid, which literally means sick. The word obesity itself means overeat in its Latin roots. And both of these terms are judgmental. Over a standard weight and has eaten more than is considered standard. Setting reference ranges around a biological standard is not necessarily a bad thing to do. It's what we do with hypertension, high blood pressure. But the BMI categorization was not determined using the distribution of BMIs in a well-nourished, active human population. It was determined around the death stats of white men who were measured in the 1940s. To look at a similar metric, age, what we have is the use of neutral terms to describe a range of humans on a continuous variable. So infancy, childhood, adolescence, adulthood, older adulthood, and elderly. We do not call young people chronologically insufficient or elderly people pretty sick and almost dead. Judgment about what is good and bad is built into the medical language that we use to refer to body mass. An alternative could be a category A, B, C, D, E for each of the BMI categories, or just use it as a number without the judgment-based categorization. The people just to either side of BMI 30 are much more like each other than they are to the people at the other end of their own categories. And there's no good scientific reason they should be separated except for our convenience for statistical analysis. And it's interesting to note that the word morbid has been consciously removed from medical usage because they realized it was stigmatizing, yet it's been replaced with extreme. I mean, the thin bias is just so pervasive. My issue too is the entanglement of BMI with assumptions about lifestyle. When BMI is assumed to be a behavior, then it's going to be wrong almost more than it's right. for all BMI categories. So food intake has some effect, but it's complicated because food is so many little parts over such a long time. And physical activity has some effect, but is also complicated as it has multiple influencing factors: frequency, intensity, resistance, cardio, which muscles are being used, at what time of life, etc., etc. When high BMI is used as a proxy for sedentary behaviour and poor dietary quality, it poisons the well. So if there is an element of higher BMI actually causing something, it needs to be controlled for health behaviours and ideally for other illness and genetic predisposition too. Okay, so what is a risk factor? And can a BMI of more than 30 be considered a risk factor? According to the World Health Organization, a risk factor is any attribute, characteristic, or exposure of an individual that increases the likelihood of developing a disease or injury. Some examples of the more important risk factors are underweight, unsafe sex, high blood pressure, tobacco and alcohol consumption, and unsafe water, sanitation, and hygiene, end quote. Note that they didn't list obesity as a risk factor. It's because they have led the world by declaring it to be a disease caused by overnutrition, and it's their decisiveness around this that has been used by other large organisations and governments to justify the label of disease. However, having a legitimate disease can also be a risk factor, in the way that having type 2 diabetes is a risk factor for heart disease. In fact, most deaths associated with diabetes are actually from cardiovascular disease-related events. So a condition or characteristics doesn't have to be either one or the other. It can be both a risk factor and a disease, which means we must consider whether or not a larger body size is justified to be deemed a risk factor, and or whether or not a larger body size is justified to be deemed a disease state. Risk factors are necessarily correlational, otherwise they would be recognized as part of the progression of a defined disease. For example, if heart disease only occurred in larger people, the larger body would be part of the diagnostic criteria, not a risk factor. And if heart disease was a predictable follow-on from a larger body mass, that is, if virtually everyone with a larger body developed it as time goes on, then heart disease would be an accepted part of the natural history of having a higher body weight. The reality is that heart disease is something that happens to humans as they age, as is weight gain, by the way, and is heavily influenced by genetics and happens across the weight span. There are factors that predispose people with larger bodies to have a somewhat elevated risk of developing heart disease, but a larger body is not sufficient or necessary for a diagnosis of heart disease. Therefore, it's just one of the many risk factors that flags that a person may be in for an eventual diagnosis of heart disease. The purpose of being interested in risk factors is to try to see into the future and predict the development of a disease or condition that needs treatment or management. So while diseases may be risk factors for other diseases, risk factors don't have to even be health factors at all. Age, sex, education level, exposure to living in poverty. The things we identify as risk factors are strongly influenced by how easy it is to measure them. Things that are easier to measure and have had a history of being measured are golden for being investigated as risk factors, not because they're better or more accurate than other risk factors, but because they're there and because we've got a fair bit of data we can crunch retrospectively. For example, the field of genetics is coming along in leaps and bounds, and the case for body weight, cardiovascular issues, and diabetes being largely genetically influenced is getting stronger all the time. It's likely that at some point in the next few decades, we'll be able to identify much more specifically who is likely to develop diabetes using their actual genetic information, rather than asking about their family history, taking their waist circumference, or looking at their blood sugar and cholesterol levels. Genetics is not the holy grail, but should help to decrease the pathologizing of these satellite risk factors just for their sometimes pretty weak association with an eventual negative health outcome. Unpacking the label of risk factor itself, some interesting things fall out when considering whether it's modifiable or behavioural risk factor, that is, something that someone can do something about, versus considering a larger body size to be an unmodifiable risk factor, an immutable characteristic that forms part of the constellation of background risks that all individuals have, which includes genetic and the social determinants of health. Being able to identify a high risk group is one thing, and it's an utterly different thing to make the blanket assumption that intentionally manipulating those risk factors will have an impact on the development of the condition. It's like cooking the books. If BMI were truly modifiable and related to a sedentary, junk food heavy lifestyle, then it must have always related to lifestyle, and thus lifestyle should have been the risk factor, not body weight. If it were modifiable but not related to lifestyle, then the intervention to shrink the body must also be closely interrogated for the risks it creates versus the risks it mitigates. In the case of weight, and I've said this 1,000 times, assuming that someone who's living in a semi-starved state to maintain a suppressed body weight has the same absolute health risks as someone who effortlessly is that lower weight, remembering that BMI risk does not account for health behaviours at all, is absurd. That comparison fails in terms of biological plausibility, and it fails in terms of actual health outcomes when those two groups are compared. Ruling that it's a modifiable risk factor means that formerly fat people are regarded as no different in terms of risk to effortlessly smaller people. This position is not supported by long-term evidence, even if there is a slight shift towards an average longer life, much of which may be related to lifestyle behaviours, the non-representative of participants in weight loss studies, survivor bias and underpowered studies. It is by no means anything like the always smaller population. Intentional weight losers have been removed from some BMI and mortality analyses because they drag up the mortality rate of lower BMI groups. These are people who have reported that their weight loss was intentional, not people who have lost weight because they were really sick. Those people are usually removed from BMI and mortality analysis as a matter of course, because as with all biological organisms, unintentional weight loss is a death knell. We like to imagine that knowing what factors are related to deathy outcomes will help us to avoid or delay death. And while that may be kind of true at a population level, the general awareness is low that it's a shifting of the average that happens, not that everyone benefits individually. Relative to smaller bodied people, a larger body increases the still lowish likelihood of being diagnosed with diabetes, high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, and some cancers. But the absolute risk, i.e. the risk of an average larger bodied person being diagnosed with one or more of these things, is not in itself that high. Let's take a diagnosis of cancer. In Australia, about 1.5% of adults with a BMI between 18.5 and 25 have a diagnosis of cancer. In Australians with a BMI of over 30, the prevalence of cancer is about 3%. So yes, the likelihood of having cancer is double if your BMI is greater than 30, and that's commonly a headline. However, people with higher BMIs also tend to be older. So the higher BMI category is not proportional to the age distribution of the population. Capturing stats from larger bodied people results in capturing stats from older people relative to the lower BMI categories. And when adjusted for age, BMI in cancer diagnosis becomes much less relevant. Aging is the single biggest risk factor for any of the conditions that are also associated with a larger body. And attempts to control aging have been superficial and ineffective, much like attempts to control body weight. So does a BMI of 30 or more warrant being considered a risk factor? On balance, I think yes, with the full disclosure that acknowledging larger body size as a risk factor should drive better screening, diagnostics and treatments for whatever the actual condition is, not manipulating weight as if that will magically disappear the factors that may be driving both body weight status and disease development processes. Now moving on to the gnarly question of the definition of disease, and then whether a BMI of more than 30 warrants that label. When we think of the word disease, we think of sickness, illness, treatment, cure. Think about these words: issue, condition, disorder, abnormal state, malfunction, pathological, maladaptive. All of these words indicate a defectiveness, an obligated treatment or management response. A mid-step might be condition, but that's still fairly pathologizing as it implies that the condition needs to be managed. Consider the word illness, which implies a temporary state from which one may recover and for which there may or may not be a treatment apart from waiting out the natural course of the illness as in time. A basic definition that I found is: a disease is generally thought of as an abnormal state or a condition that prevents the body from functioning properly. But I found many varied definitions, appearing to have been tweaked to try to justify the author's already set position on the status of a condition or characteristics. The debate, particularly about whether obesity is a disease, rages on, with news stories and scientific articles appearing regularly over the past 25 or more years. I'm going to read an excerpt from a 2001 paper that aimed to pin down what the definition of a disease is and explore whether obesity fits the bill. It's quite long, but it says what I want to say much more eloquently than I could muster. From these and other definitions, we identified the following common and recurring components: A, a condition of the body, its parts, organs, or systems, or an alteration thereof. B, resulting from infection, parasites, nutritional, dietary, environmental, genetic, or other causes. C, having a characteristic, identifiable, marked group of symptoms or signs. D, deviation from normal structure or function, variously described as abnormal structure or function, incorrect function, impairment of normal state, interruption, disturbance, cessation, disorder, derangement of bodily or organ functions. How well does obesity fit the definition of disease? There should be little disagreement that obesity satisfies conditions A and B above. That is, A, an excess accumulation of fat can certainly be thought of as a condition of the body, and as for B, the list of potential causes is so extensive that the causes of obesity must surely be found there. Condition C poses a problem. Indeed, obesity can be diagnosed visually from physical proportions or with the help of height and weight measurements. In cases of doubt, body composition methodologies offer numerous methods to measure body fat to the required degree of precision. However, there are no signs that inevitably characterize the condition other than the excess adiposity, which is the definition of obesity. The causes of obesity are numerous and diverse, ranging from and including combinations of environmental, behavioral, and genetic aspects of energy intake, partitioning, and expenditure. Its common accompaniments, impaired glucose tolerance, dyslipidemia, hypertension, are not inevitably present. Thus, condition C is met, but only in a circular or tautological sense. The only characteristic, identifiable sign of obesity, is also the characteristics which defines obesity, i.e. fatness. Condition D is even more problematic. The deviations specified range from simple deviation from normality to impairment, interruption, or cessation of vital functions. Moreover, what is meant by deviation from normality is not clear. It can imply undesirable variation or simple statistical rarity. Evidence for impaired physical and social functioning in severe obesity, e.g. BMI more than 40, clearly exists. In these cases, excess fat is usually accompanied by various signs of impairment, and it can be argued that severe or extreme obesity would usually meet condition D for most definitions of disease, including those which specify impairment of function. However, impairment is not inevitable or even usual in most persons who meet the present BMI or percentage fat criteria for obesity. In contrast to severe obesity, mild obesity only threatens eventual impairment in as much as a risk factor by definition confers a greater probability of some future adverse event. Yet its association with these events is, at our present state of understanding, probabilistic. We cannot foretell who will develop an obesity-related health problem. In fact, some persons who meet the criteria for obesity will live long lives free of any of the morbidities known to be influenced by obesity. We're therefore placed in the conceptually awkward position of declaring a disease which, for some of its victims, entails no affliction. Many obese persons are competent, functioning members of society, nor do these persons necessarily subjectively consider themselves impaired, except perhaps insofar as they feel themselves victims of social discrimination. They might fail to meet some arbitrary standard of physical fitness, for example, climbing stairs or running, but such a standard would also exceed the capability of many non-obese but sedentary individuals. While physical fitness is desirable, its absence has not generally been considered an impairment. It would be possible to set an arbitrary standard of fitness which many obese and non-obese people would fail to meet, and to consider this as evidence of impairment. However, the present criteria for obesity do not do so. End quote. Now, this is the key issue for me. How can an entire disease be based on one metric that is the result of normal biological function with literally no signs needing to be necessary there that there's any malfunction in the organism? If energy intake exceeds requirements, the normal biological function is to store it. Energy storage isn't pathological. If this is a disease, it's one that can be cured with a bowel motion, an amputation, a restrictive eating disorder, a week on bed rest, or a dodgy set of scales, while the more legitimate treatments offered are unlikely to actually result in more than a few percentage points of weight loss, leaving people permanently diseased, continuously hassled by health professionals to lose more weight, yet in their yet otherwise perfectly healthy state. I have an example of how this then opens the door to gaslighting and infantising of people with larger bodies. A research consequence of labelling high weight as a disease or health disorder is that people with larger bodies who self-rate their health as good or excellent are being accused of being delusional and in need of someone to tell them that they're actually unhealthy. Many clinical practice guidelines recommend that primary care providers inform people if their weight places them in the overweight or obese categories, with the argument that if they're not aware, then they'll want to do something about it. I found a paper from the region that I live in that reported a study of local residents, my neighbours, their self-rated health status, their BMI, and what conditions they had, and the paper made a huge song and dance about how many larger people rated themselves highly for their health when, in their opinion, they shouldn't have. Nowhere in the paper did they critically examine that these results could have the consequence of overdiagnosis and unnecessarily pathologizing a body state. I'll read from the paper. Surprisingly, 85.4% of residents who were overweight and 71.1% of those who were obese reported that their health was good, very good, or excellent, while greater than 50% of residents with heart disease, high or low blood pressure, high cholesterol, high triglycerides, thyroid disorder, diabetes, and osteopenia or osteoporosis reported that their health was good, very good, or excellent. End quote. And I actually find this to be great news. What this actually means is that those in larger bodies without a condition that needs management are not pathologizing themselves. And those that do have a condition that needs management are managing well. They're taking their medication, they're engaging in self-care and feeling healthy. Reporting that they have an inaccurate health perception and concluding that they must then not have the desire to alter their lifestyle to improve their health is just so erroneous. They were never asked about their desire to maintain a healthy lifestyle. Also, once you've been diagnosed with progressive conditions like heart disease or high blood pressure or high triglycerides, you end up tending to keep that diagnostic label indefinitely, even if the condition is being managed well with lifestyle or medication. Here's a question. Does someone who's taking medication to manage high blood pressure actually have high blood pressure anymore? The having high blood pressure is the risk factor, so surely no longer having high blood pressure because the medication is effective for me means that I'm not technically unhealthy? Perhaps I would be less healthy without the medication, but you could make similar arguments of logic about food, clean drinking water, even air. There are lots of components that the human needs in place to support unencumbered function. The blanket statement that a larger body is inherently unhealthy is clearly out of step with how people feel about themselves out in the community. Further, we know from a vast number of studies that mortality risk is double in people who rate their own health as poor compared with those who rate it as excellent, no matter what medicine has deemed their health status as. If we're the reason that they're rating their health as poor because we've told them they're diseased despite showing no actual evidence of life-limiting disease, then it is possible that we are setting into motion a phenomenon that will actually impact negatively on their lifespan. This is teased out a lot more in the overdiagnosis literature if you want a rabbit hole to go down this weekend. Some people and organisations argued against higher weight being called a disease because they felt that if people with larger bodies were given the impression that their condition was incurable, that they would stop trying to fix their lifestyles and rely on expensive medical treatments. And others argue that it can be fixed with lifestyle, so therefore it's a personal matter and doesn't warrant medical treatment at all. This is obviously the don't waste my tax dollars on your bad decisions argument, along with the you don't deserve any care if you're fat since you obviously want to be that way argument, and the how dare you accept failure argument. It's an ignorant mess, but they were the arguments. It's also a pretty frequent argument made against size acceptance in general, so not surprising, but interesting that both size acceptance advocates and fatphobic ignorant morons were advocating for it not to be considered a disease. Frenemies? The Hayes advocate's position is, it's complicated, but not as big a deal as everyone is hysterically pushing. Please see the actual evidence and recognise that I have the right to body autonomy anyway, even if it's against your medical wishes. Please don't discriminate against me and please learn to take care of my body as it is, because it's likely to stay pretty much this way unless you induce malnutrition in me by surgically reorganising my body's nourishment system. So what about the arguments for labelling a higher BMI as a disease? Who is saying what and why? Basically, the FOR camp is made up of antiobesity.org and antiobesity.inc and the people who believe them, some of whom have larger bodies too and have swallowed the messaging about being fat being the same as being sick. So antiobesity.inc is the weight loss industry, who stands to perpetually make bank by claiming that their services are therefore therapeutic because they can elicit a short-term weight loss. Looking at you, WW, Slimming World and Jenny Craig, this group also includes all registered health, medical, counselling and fitness professionals who offer weight loss services, as well as every kind of variation of weight loss peddler. Those big anti-obesity.inc players who want to keep the gravy train going make generous contributions to anti-obesity.org in order to boost their credibility in the court of public and governmental opinion. So anti-obesity.org are the anti-obesity clinicians, researchers, and organizations who represent anti-obesity clinicians and researchers or provide weight loss appliances like lap bands and pharmaceuticals like weight loss drugs, such as the World Obesity Foundation and the Obesity Society. They are wholly made up of people and organizations who assert that a larger body is a dangerous thing and should be avoided or aggressively treated. So that means that the World Health Organization is part of antiobesity.org as well. They're the more presentable version of antiobesity.inc. They listen to problems with weight stigma, but they still think that fatness is bad. If antiobesity.inc are the used car salesmen of the field, antiobesity.org is the slick company that sells pretty hybrid cars because they're better for the environment, all the while perpetuating the materialistic mess that is royally screwing the earth anyway. The obesity societies lament that not more people take up the highly effective treatment that is bariatric surgery and consult only with obese people who would rather not be larger anymore. They fight hard for bariatric surgery to be included in health insurance policies and for people to be able to access their superannuation to pay for the surgery if it cannot be covered any other way. Their focus is on well-being and health related to weight loss efforts only, and their position is that they're advocating for larger people who want to lose weight. They're hugely influential to government thanks to medical privilege and industry funding. They argue that obesity is complicated, and to avoid society having a simplistic idea of why someone has a larger body, calling it a disease should make the public and government think it's complicated and feel like we should all take action. As an example, in The Lancet last year, they called for obesity to be recognised as a disease because they believed that it would put pressure on governments to regulate the food environment instead of blaming individuals for what they assume are their choices. Yes, the food environment could use some regulation to support people of all weights to be able to access and enjoy a nourishing variety of foods, but the argument for food environment regulation could have been made persuasively without staining the reputations of two-thirds of the population. The other argument is that calling it a disease should mean that the community see it more seriously and understand that it's not a matter of personal choice. What people who advocate for this fail to understand is that the community is unlikely to change their mind about what causes obesity, and instead, labelling it a disease endorses the "you're killing yourself" narrative and has had a knock-on effect to diabetes, with many people incorrectly now thinking you can eat your way to a diabetes diagnosis. If it is a disease, then it's one where the majority of those with it are asymptomatic, that is, they suffer no symptoms or consequences from having the condition. We managed to recognise that fair skin is a risk factor for skin cancer and encourage everyone to wear sunscreen without labelling fair skin as a disease state. This decision to label it as a disease has consequences for all of the stakeholders in body weight, people who have the bodies that have now been deemed diseased, and people whose livelihoods are based on carrying out interventions that claim to treat this disease. Now, that last consideration, the evidence for the consequences of medicalising body state. We have quite a few years now since BMI of more than 30 was deemed a disease by the American Medical Association, World Health Organization, and various governments. Has making it a disease state led to more funding for research and treatment? Yes. Has it led to more government visibility and policy energy? Yes. Has it led to more awareness in the general population of the risks of having a larger body? Yes. But all of these things are only good things, only if your position is that it is a disease. Antiobesity.org and antiobesity.inc have had their way. What about the people who are deemed diseased by their BMI? Does the general public now understand that the reasons for having a larger body size are very rarely eating and moving habits? No. And do they realise the difficulty in becoming smaller is far more complicated than lifestyle? No. But thin people are now very happy to remind every large person that they're inherently unhealthy, and people vulnerable to devaluing themselves have increased levels of internalised weight stigma. The public thinking that obesity is a disease has not led to more sympathy and acceptance, but to people saying, well, now you're unhealthy, only smaller people are healthy, and it's your fault, so you get no sympathy. Weight stigma research shows that externalised and internalised weight stigma is getting worse and having terrible effects on people with larger bodies and polarising public opinion about body size. A study from Spain that interviewed physicians and their larger adolescent patients to investigate the impact of medicalising larger body size concluded, "The medicalisation of obesity has not served to limit the stigmatisation and discriminatory treatment to which these obese persons are subject because of their body size. Instead, by making obese persons individually responsible for their fatness, biomedical discourse fuels and even legitimises fat phobia." End quote. The designation of BMI of over 30 as a disease is part of an epic global swindle, starting off with well-placed concern about the link between body size and ill health. Realizing that it's actually quite complicated has turned into marketing 101. Create a problem which creates panic about the problem, which creates a market for fixing the problem, then mark the cost of ineffective treatments for the problem as being part of the cost of the problem to create even more panic, which fuels the market even more. It's out of control. Want to bring down costs? Treat people for the ailments they actually have instead of creating new ones and the need for them to be treated as well. Want public health campaigns to positively impact on public health? Make them beneficial for the whole community and do not use stigma and shame to try to drive behaviour change. Want the general public to know the truth about weight control? Stop people and companies that sell weight loss from falsely advertising their services and run awareness campaigns that destigmatise body diversity. So that's it for this episode. The supporting materials, which include the show notes, research links, and self-test quiz, are available upfront for current subscribers, only $5 a month, which is a bargain, or can be purchased in a bundle if you're catching up later. You see unpackingweightscience.com for details. Next time, episode 19 is defining diet culture. Diet culture is something that we talk about as toxic a lot in the eating disorder treatment and health at every size world, but what is it? In this episode, I'll be unpacking what constitutes body and diet culture, how to spot it in health services, research, sport and society, and what we can do to dismantle it. Until next time, goodbye.